Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, which for this month only is your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to director Matthew John Lawrence about his second feature, the punk rock horror comedy, Uncle Peckerhead. Over the course of the interview, I chat to Matthew about the development of the Uncle Peckerhead character, how the film both pays homage to and satirizes the punk rock scene, and how the movie is part of a planned trilogy. Elsewhere in the interview, Matthew talks about the harsh realities of indie filmmaking, as well as giving us a sneak peek on what he is working on next. All of which and much, much more you can hear in the interview with Matt right now.
Hi, Matthew. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Scott, thanks so much for having me.
No problem at all. So we're here to talk to you about your feature, Uncle Peckerhead. For the listener, can you give us a brief spoiler-free synopsis of Uncle Peckerhead?
Sure. Well, Uncle Peckerhead is a horror comedy about a three-piece punk band who embark on their first tour. And it just so happens that their hillbilly roadie is a man-eating monster that turns into said monster for 13 minutes starting at midnight every night.
And where did the initial idea for Uncle Peckerhead come about?
Yeah, so Uncle Peckerhead was kind of a mix of a bunch of different ideas I had been kind of like wrestling with or had been percolating for quite some time. The first idea, which I'd really been pushing, is I had this idea for an Adult Swim series about a punk band living in a row house that had this like old hillbilly living with them. And the show would be kind of shot like an early 90s sitcom with, you know, just like five rotating stages and a laugh track with the audience, really no horror elements. And I always described it as kind of like a punk rock Full House meets a redneck Mr. Belvedere. And so I had that idea. I'd been pushing that for the better part of a year. And I had also, since I had been in bands in my 20s and I had toured a bunch, as I wanted to kind of create a road trip movie about a band on tour to kind of showcase all of these stories that I had experienced and a lot of my friends that had experienced, including Jeff Riddle, who plays Max in the film and wrote all the music for Duh. And I mean, also I had wanted to do a horror movie because I had my last film had been a horror comedy. I had been producing a few horror films. And I went to a film festival where a lot of the feature films that were playing, though they might have been really well executed or some of them were really great films, there wasn't any like great midnight movie. A lot of the films were really self-serious, dramatic, and there's always a need for that in the horror world. But I really saw kind of this absence of, you know, the type of film like when you first see Evil Dead or you first see, you know, Dead Alive and those type of movies that they weren't playing. A film like that wasn't playing at any of the festivals I was attending. So like one night, you know, after some drinks with my then girlfriend, now wife, who is a co-producer, I was just like, you know, I think I have an idea of how I can mix all of these three separate ideas I'd been kind of developing for quite some time into kind of one mega, mega idea. And then like within probably 6 months, I had the script, you know, pretty much locked for Uncle Peckerhead.
So kind of sewing these three disparate ideas together, it seems like it wasn't too difficult a process that you seems quite smooth.
I mean, it was really odd because, I mean, you know, having a bunch of scripts under my belt is most of the time during my writing process, I agonize. And this was by far the quickest script I had written in my short career. And I'm telling you, yeah, I mean, I would say like a lot of what you see in the film was in that first draft. I mean, there's a few like elements that changed, like, you know, in terms of structure, in terms of like the skeleton. Surprisingly, you know, from, you know, the initial seedling of that, of those ideas. And like you said, they're, you know, initially being so disparate, it was a relatively, I mean, the screenwriting process for Uncle Peckerhead was by far the easiest process during the entirety of pre-production and then post-production. It was by far the most pleasant and the easiest for me.
And how quickly did it go from script to going into production?
I mean, really, it was a pretty wild, the last film festival I went to where I kind of had this moment with my wife, I think was like at some point in the spring of 2017, I wrote the script for Uncle Peckerhead starting that summer of 2017, basically had the script locked by, I'd say, like November, really before the new year, before 2018. And then I would say like around the new year had committed to shooting it with a few of the producers and a few of the people like Jeff, who I mentioned, who wrote the music involved. So starting in like the beginning of 2018, we committed to shoot it, and then we shot it in June of 2018. So then that's another, I don't know how many, 5-6 months of intense pre-production, and then we shot for 3 weeks in June.
And how did the cast come together? Quite a lot of the strength and charm in the film comes from the chemistry of the band. And so obviously you'd have to be quite careful in terms of like finding the right personalities to jive off each other. How long was the casting process, and how did you get the band's members together, Chet, Jeff, and Ruby?
So Jeff's been a friend of mine for a decade. He's been in my other, in a few of my other films. And I knew I wanted him in the film. I knew, not only did I want him to perform, but I had asked him if he would write the music. Actually, what had happened is I wanted to use one of his former songs in the movie. And then he offered to write a completely new record of new tunes, for this fictional band. So Jeff was the first person on board and was like one of the first people involved in the pre-production process. From there, we did casting sessions, and I had known of Chet, who played Judy in the film, and Ruby, who had played Mel in the film. And they came in and read, and they were our first choice, and they were really game. So that was actually relatively easy in terms of the casting process. The toughest part of the casting process was definitely in finding Peckerhead. I didn't have anybody in mind. I didn't want to kind of get my hopes up and have somebody in mind, and then they wouldn't want to do it, or they couldn't do it. So we just kind of had this blind casting call, and we're a micro budget production. It was completely DIY. A lot of it is like begging, borrowing, stealing. So we had, which for our micro budget was like a pretty extensive casting call for Peck. I would say like at least 2 full days, maybe 3, which for us was like, you know, forever. And no one came close to what I had kind of imagined for that role. And we kind of reached this impasse where, you know, it was like, are we going to go forward? Are we still shooting in June? We don't have probably one of the most important performances kind of lined up. Like, what should we do? And I mean, I'm telling you, it was like, you know, fate or kismet, whatever you want to call it. Within 2 days of kind of having that conversation, David Littleton, who plays Peck in the movie, was in Florida, so he couldn't make our Brooklyn casting calls, but he sent a video audition to one of our producers. And it was amazing because the producer forwarded me the video, and she was like, hey, I think this guy may be it. And it was David did in the film. There's this big, this diner scene where David kind of gives his origin story, and it's this very kind of playful, dynamic dialogue scene. And I mean, David did it exactly like what you see in the film. And it's like a 5-minute uninterrupted. I mean, he just kind of like had it nailed. So as soon as we saw it, like the next, that literally like the next text is, I was like, we have to get him up to Brooklyn just to see him with the rest of the cast, because we had already had Chet, Ruby, and Jeff kind of locked in. David came in, he read, and he was, I mean, David is one of the best collaborators I've worked with, and that a director could really ask for. So from there, it just kind of like, it really took off. And it means so much to hear you say that the dynamic between them and just like the performances themselves, you know, is such a strength, because as a director, it really made my job easy to have such like wonderful kind of collaborators in that main cast, and also all the supporting cast who also killed it.
And they seem quite believable as well as a band. And David has a kind of look of a kind of roadie to him as well. So it seemed quite authentic from that standpoint.
Totally. And Scott, I think it's like it was definitely there in like when we did kind of we only got enough time to do like basically two rehearsals or read throughs. But what was really great about the actual filmmaking process is that the van that the band travels in is Jeff's van, who plays Max in the film. And they would travel to set together, the four of them. And they would travel, like, and we were kind of on a road trip of our own or a tour of our own with the production because we shot in Brooklyn, Philly, New Jersey. So there was a lot of driving involved. And really, I mean, the four of them kind of like, they stayed together, you know, they resided together, they ate together, they toured, they really traveled in the van, just the four of them. And I think that kind of really, I mean, within like, you know, the first day or two, it kind of really like solidified that camaraderie and that feeling that they were really kind of a band that was kind of on the run or on tour.
And I was wondering, how difficult was the filming process in terms of, obviously, you're a small budget production, you're filming in different locations, you're on the road, there's a bunch of gore effects, you know, this, I imagine, was it quite difficult shoot, or how smooth was it?
Oh, it was anything but smooth. You really worded it beautifully. We were a micro budget DIY operation. So every favor was called in. We begged, we borrowed, we stole anything we could get our hands on. And even with that, it was still, everyone was stretched thin. So you can take it in that the experience, I mean, it was really tough. And I think it was tough for everyone involved. But that really speaks to the dedication, the talents, the will of the cast and crew. Everyone, I'm sure you know, but like, you know, and I'm sure many people listening probably know, on a micro budget shoot, everyone has, you know, the role that they're being credited for on screen, but in reality, they're wearing 12 or dozens of hats, right? So, I mean, like, that was really, what was so inspirational for me, right, is that, like, I'm getting no sleep, you're burning the candle at both ends, but, you know, at any point in which you're kind of feeling sorry for yourself, or you feel kind of like, you're feeling kind of butthurt about something, or you're feeling kind of like moody, is you just look out onto the set, and, you know, it's a small, scrappy crew, but everyone, including, you know, like, whether it's, you know, our production manager, who also plays Shiloh, who's kind of the antagonist in the film, he's acting, he's working craft services, he's also production managing. My wife was the wardrobe person, the production designer, a co-producer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just seeing like how everyone was so dedicated, so warm, and also like what goes a long way in those situations, just so nice to each other, just so kind. I mean, it really inspired me to kind of like, you know, swallow it or kind of like grin and bear it, because everyone else was working just as hard, if not harder.
It's interesting you bring up the character of Shiloh. I thought that was quite entertaining. It really kind of nails a certain kind of pretentious archetype of somebody who, in kind of, you get in indie, you get in punk, you get in various different music where you think they're a kind of genius poet and think they have kind of great depth and know a lot about politics in a way that they don't. And also this interaction with Judy on the bench was quite interesting, because I've seen that a lot as well, of that kind of condescension towards female musicians. I mean, partly because my fiance is a drummer, and so I've seen some interactions like that.
Totally. I mean, and a lot of kind of the inspiration for, I mean, that's so cool about your girlfriend, is that the band I was in, the band that I toured in, we had it was a girlfriend of mine, and it was crazy because it was a majority male band, and she by far had her shit together. I mean, she was like kind of the person that booked the tour or would book the tours, was kind of the communications liaison type person. And it was crazy when we would like show up to venues or whatever, the type of condescension that she would suffer through versus any one of us if we went up to the promoter or asked for our money or our cut. And that's one thing that, like, you know, whether it's Shiloh, somebody in like a rival band, or like the promoters, is just this idea of this, it's a shame that it still needs to be said, is the double standard in how, you know, women specifically in rock music or in punk music or just the music industry in general are treated as kind of second class citizens, or they haven't earned their stripes enough, whatever you want to call it. And I first got wind of it in my 20s, you know, but I'd been playing in bands since I was in high school, but just being so unaware, you know, not really kind of realizing whether you call it privilege or whether you call it just like this idea of, you know, being kind of art, like hyped by people because of your gender, or, you know, it can be in many different forms in the music industry, your sexual orientation, your race or your ethnicity. But yeah, and just to kind of go back and talk about Shiloh, I mean, Shiloh is kind of like a mixture of a bunch of different ideas. Like Ryan, who played Shiloh, has been my best friend for the past 15 years. We've worked on, I think, every film that I've ever made. He's had some involvement in, and he had this kind of pretentious philosopher character. And I basically just sent him a lot of interviews with like Jared Leto from 30 Seconds to Mars. And like a bunch of these kind of like, again, you like worded it so perfectly, these kind of rock stars that are so clueless and insufferable and think that they're doing some, like doing God's work or something. Like they feel like they've been kind of anointed by some like higher power or some deity. And it's it's totally fine to kind of take your work seriously. I love when people aren't flipping about what they do, and kind of answer it earnestly and honestly. But there's just like that type of attitude and the way they carry themselves and the way they condescend to other people, or even whether it's the person interviewing them or just like other musicians that they're kind of like occupying the same space with. It blew my mind. So for Ryan, really the only two things that I told him to harness was that character he had kind of already conceptualized. And I just would send him videos of these musicians that just, I couldn't stand like 5 minutes of listening to a YouTube interview. So that's really kind of, Shiloh is kind of amalgamation of all those kind of characters.
There is some people who are just, I mean, Jared Leto was a good one, you know, and he's definitely one of the ones I thought of when seeing that character. And even though it's, you know, it's more of the kind of indie rock thing, like somebody like Matt Healy from the 1975.
Oh my God, yeah.
You know, somebody like that, I also thought of that. And I was just like, yes, it just nailed that. It was just a certain type.
Yeah, I mean, Ryan is just kind of masterful in kind of being able to kind of like focus in on just like, even like body language and stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad that you're so tuned in to what we were trying to do with that character.
I was going to ask about Uncle Peckerhead as well, in terms of like when you imagined him while writing the script, how close is the finished product to like what your imagination of what the character would look like?
It's pretty crazy. It was close. I mean, David brought it to another level because it becomes flesh and blood, which is something that even if you're creatively minded and you have a really vivid imagination, there's just something of seeing a character that you've written and you have a good idea and you're really kind of clear in what you want and clear in the voice of that character. But really, I mean, David just bringing like the flesh and bloodness to it. It blows your mind. And in reality, just this idea of fate is, you know, I'd always imagined him as this kind of hillbilly. But David grew up in Houston and kind of had a certain vision of that character, but also like right before he came into principal photography for Peckerhead, he was doing a play where he was an Appalachian coal miner. So he kind of like, that was already starting to kind of like bake in him. That was just kind of like getting lucky in that David and I kind of had a hive mind together on that character. And there was very little direction I had to give him. I think he really read the script, really understood it, and gave it his voice and his like his energy, which just coincidentally was exactly what I was looking for that character.
And in terms of the kind of carnage that he wreaks, what was the kind of most complicated of the gore effects?
Oh man,
kind of set pieces.
Yeah, so like without giving away spoilers, there's a moment when the rival band kind of has their comeuppance, and that was by far the toughest because we thought we might have the money to build a set to kind of have to execute that because what I had envisioned it was much bigger and crazier. And then slowly we realized we didn't have the funds to do that. So then it was finding someone that would let us shoot in their space. And then what ended up happening, to make a long story less long, we convinced my now sister-in-law to let us use her apartment in Brooklyn because she was going to Sweden for a month. And it was tough because it's a Brooklyn apartment, so it was super small. Obviously, like air conditioning, ventilation is an issue. Even though we were a small, scrappy crew, I mean, still, like, you know, when you have 12, 15 people in one space and you have these prosthetics and makeup, it's just really tough. And I should give a shout out to our effects guru, Jared, and his assistant, Sean, who just did a masterful job. Really brought, like, we really didn't have to cut much from the script. And it wasn't because he couldn't do it. It's because maybe we didn't have the time or money to do it. But he did such a great job. But that was just so tough because it was like, one, we did it and I felt that like we didn't really get the coverage because we didn't have the time, because we didn't have the money, because we didn't have like enough time in the schedule to get certain stuff done. And then what ended up happening is we destroyed the space. And what happened was somebody, was supposed to call a cleaning crew and they didn't call the cleaning crew. And this was on a weekend, so we couldn't even find a last minute cleaning crew to kind of like do it. So what happened was on our day off, we had Sundays off, myself, Jeff, Ryan, who played Shiloh in our UPM, and my wife, Wiki. I mean, we also used another room to do the promoter gore scene. And we had to basically clean this entire apartment. And we didn't even get done. We did like basically, with no exaggeration, like at least 20 hours of cleaning, like no sleep, just kind of working into the night and the next day. And I mean, it was just like, I had to go back on several occasions. I basically had to kind of like redo the apartment, repaint it, like kind of like work on the paneling and stuff like that. It was just like one of those things that you knew it was going to be a big undertaking, but in terms of the actual kind of suffering through the entire experience, I mean, that sequence in and of itself took like a day and a half to shoot, and we didn't even, you know, we had to kind of like really kind of fuss with it to kind of make it work. But then, I mean, it took like probably another 3 weeks of like cleaning up, repainting, refinishing, all that shit. So it was just like it was so tough. It was such a nightmare. And everyone was just kind of hot and miserable in this Brooklyn apartment with no ventilation.
I also wanted to talk about the story a little. Like, I don't want to go too far into spoiler territory either, obviously, for people who have not seen the film. But I did want to ask you about this because relatively early on in the movie, you make two quite interesting choices that might be unexpected. One, Uncle Peckerhead, the band witness him and you make them complicit quite early on. And also when Judy reveals to the other band members that the true nature of Uncle Peckerhead, they automatically believe her, which is not how you would expect it. And, you know, expect this story to go, being a horror fan. You know, you would expect it to go the other way, that the murders are happening behind the band's back. And when it is revealed, like, there's a big argument about, do we believe this? No, some people don't, some people do. Was that a very conscious decision to go against the grain?
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted it to be is, like, one of the major themes that I guess you could say I wanted to explore, or, like, really kind of what I wanted the crux of the story to be, is I wanted it to be this kind of Faustian tale of, you know, somebody who's so motivated, so passionate, so ambitious, that it gets to the point where it gets the better of her, is, like, not just her, but the band is willing to kind of overlook or just kind of pretend it's not happening and kind of like lie to themselves of really kind of the what's going on and kind of the extent to which the damage, the destruction, the death, because it serves their betterment, which is just, I mean, there's so much there that I find really interesting. And there's like larger themes that I really kind of wanted to explore, especially what's going on in the United States right now and stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, that was baked into the cake early on. And like, I would say even the first draft is I wanted them to be aware. And even when they're not aware of the extent, they actually, I mean, like in reality, I think Judy knew the extent to which Peck was destroying and devouring. She just like wasn't willing to consciously engage with that until the end, when it became a problem, right? When they are literally covered in shit, you know what I mean? So yeah, I mean, that's something that I really did want to explore, and I wanted one of the major themes to be kind of that Faustian tale or that devil's bargain of, you know, getting what you want, having this dream, and in order to achieve the dream, you're willing to achieve it at any cost, even if it's someone else's destruction.
On the back of that, how careful were you then when kind of constructing the characters? And again, you know, going back to the casting, because it feels like the story could quickly fall apart if the characters were not fundamentally likable and rootable. Even Uncle Peckerhead, to an extent, you know, he's quite charming, and you know he's doing these terrible things, but you kind of overlook it to an extent. And how careful were you when coming up with these characters of thinking of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like a great take or like a great way of kind of couching that question, because I mean, the idea is one thing that like I try and do in all my films, that it's a lot of the movies that are kind of my favorites or the movies I revisit are movies that have heart. And even if you have characters that are deeply flawed or do kind of heinous things, you know, there, like in the movie, there's this sense that, you know, Duh, the band is kind of this kind of fucked up, like nuclear family, and that Judy's the mom. You kind of have the angsty teen and Mel, and you kind of, and you have kind of the precocious little boy and Jeff, but they need each other. There's kind of like this, and they really care for each other. They look out for each other. And with Peckerhead is I didn't want to have, I don't even know if I would consider him to be the main antagonist, though he is by many people's standards. But I did want to create a very likable, charismatic character that also really wanted to belong. I mean, I think ultimately like there's some really deep darkness and some things that you can't square up with him. But really, like he's looking for his family. You know, he's looking to kind of join this nuclear family. He's not looking to bring any harm to them. But I think that's what's interesting. And I mean, just kind of like, I'll try and throw this in. I won't try and shoehorn it, but this kind of like speaks to something. One of the other themes that I kind of wanted to explore in the film is, at the time I was writing the film, you know, and again, not to give him any air, any more air than he has, but, you know, Donald Trump had been elected, and there was a lot of kind of editorials a year into his presidency that were kind of like, you know, theorizing why he got elected. And the big one that a lot of editorials had was, you know, these blue collar, you know, middle-aged white guys felt that the world had left them behind. So they were willing to, you know, go for this kind of like break it all, burn it all kind of candidate, because they felt that, you know, that they were left behind by the ever-changing world or culture. And I felt that, like, you know, when I started writing Peckerhead, that I kind of saw that in that, like, because they described, like, these are your uncles at the Thanksgiving dinner table, you know, that you're arguing with, is that, you know, they're the uncles that were maybe the fun uncles when you were a little kid, but then, like, you just have these deep fundamental differences in what's right or what's just or whatever. And that's kind of how I saw it, is Peckerhead is this charismatic guy that it genuinely you like, you know, on the surface. You could have a beer with him, he's great. But then when you see that he's deeply destructive, and when you try to kind of like check him on his destruction, he's not willing to hear you out, and he's willing to destroy you in the process. You know, and that's kind of how I mean, that's how I kind of see what's going on in the world right now. And that's, even though, yeah, I mean, I also don't want to get it twisted in that Peckerhead is a madcap gore fest of shit, piss, vomit, and blood. But there, like, I really did try to kind of talk about the, like, those themes, and that's why I wanted to kind of create characters that, you know, both were capable of really deep, caring moments or connective moments, but also, you know, a lot of them, you know, whether they're witness to and they're kind of like, they allow it because they lie to themselves, or they are the ones, you know, that are doing the destruction. You know, this character, you know, just having a lot of gray area, which I think makes the audience be able to connect with it a lot more, or perhaps in an easier way.
I mean, I think you nailed it on the head there, that it is like a kind of horror comedy gore fest full of blood, piss, shit, and blood, vomit, you know, like all of those things. But like you say, it's got these kind of more serious themes kind of baked in. Were you at all concerned that the kind of hard left turn into slightly more serious, slightly darker territory towards the end would lose you some of your audience?
You know, that's a really great question, because again, like, it's so tough, because I've read, you know, in the criticism of, in some of the criticism of Peckerhead, that's probably the biggest complaint, right? Is like, there's a tonal shift. And it's like, I also, like, and I know you're not asking me to, but I also don't want to be that filmmaker that every time they get criticism, they're just like, they put up a wall and they're like, well, I did it because of this, right? Or that's actually like a wrong take, because here's what I was thinking. Is I think that's valid. I'm fine with that shift, because I think with the themes I wanted to explore, you know, whether like some people have seen kind of a theme of drug addiction, whether you want to see it in terms of like a socio-political kind of statement or whatever, I think that that's kind of how it is like, shit's fun until it's not, you know, like, I don't think that, you know, and even I think there are kind of these hints as the movie goes along that there's going to be this shift, that like things aren't what they seem. And while it could be all kind of like fun and games, you know, ultimately, there, you know, the chicken's going to come home to roost, you know what I mean? And there's going to be this reckoning moment. So for me, I mean, I felt fine with it. I was conscious of that it was going to take a really kind of dark, sinister turn, as you put it. But I definitely, I mean, I see the criticism. I see that some people wanted, I'm not sure what they wanted, or I'm not sure if they have something specific in mind, but I definitely see that criticism, I see that take, but for me, I mean, that it was intentional, maybe it wasn't executed in the best way possible, but I did feel that was kind of baked into the narrative, and it kind of like, it does for me kind of mirror however you want to look at those themes, you know, of differences between generations, of like, you know, coming to like these kind of like abrupt stops in whether it's dialogue or you know, camaraderie or whatever it is. But it's like, you know, like with friends that are on drugs and, you know, or drink a lot, you know, like, especially if you're a bit of like a partier, it's really fun until it's not anymore. You know what I mean? Like, like there is kind of this, like you do, I mean, you are kind of like hitting a wall in that, like, you might look back and be like, oh man, I should have seen it here and there. And that's kind of what the characters kind of, when they have that moment of reflection, they know they kind of were lying to themselves. But yeah, I mean, I go back and forth, because that's something that I've been thinking about a bit from like reading reviews and just hearing, you know, friends and people like, you know, that have done interviews with kind of asking me about it, is, you know, I felt kind of comfortable with it. I felt that it was kind of earned. But I can definitely see, you know, the other side of the coin, where, you know, people think they're on for one type of movie and then there's that shift. Whereas I wanted it to be I wanted that shift to happen. Some people didn't.
But yeah, I think, like, what was I going to ask there? I think I suppose it's quite a kind of hard left turn. Did you want it to be quite as abrupt a tonal shift as that, you know, just to kind of snap you out of it? Like, you know, like you said, it's fun until it's not. Boom.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, to me, and again, this is the person who's the most intimately aware, but also has the least objectivity, right? Is I think there are a ton of like small moments where, you know, he's lying, you know, you as the audience, or at least I thought I could telegraph to that audience that he's lying, and the band's kind of fooling themselves. And then when they're kind of confronted with when they cannot turn a blind eye, right? When they cannot separate and be in different rooms at midnight and stuff like that, that's when they're confronted with it. And that's when it takes that turn. So yeah, I mean, and I know what you're talking about. Cause like I've seen and I've read like a bunch of reviews and stuff where they talk about like the sharp turn. I don't know if I find it that sharp, but again, you're talking to the person that's the least objective party, you know? So I think to me, I was trying to telegraph a little bit more. If some people or a segment of the people that watched it didn't get those telegraphs, obviously like I needed to do a better job of doing that, or I needed to find different ways to kind of like, you know, telegraph that. But, you know, like there's like that moment when Judy's kind of in the van after they kind of stop after kind of like the flashback scene of the rival band kind of demise, is they stop the van and she's kind of like going through all of kind of these moments and realizing that she's kind of, at least to me, there's this moment of realization that she's been lying to herself. She's like, just, she hasn't been willing to kind of confront the idea that like clearly he is off doing his own thing and they're kind of leaving him to it every night. And she's just been like, oh, well, like he has a, you know, I'll just take his word for it. So yeah, I mean, it's so tough is like, you know, with the sharp turn, I definitely see kind of like I see where people are coming from, but it's tough for me to kind of say, you know, I mean, for me, I wanted it to be kind of intentional in that it's fun till it's not. But for some people, like in terms of like, you know, the medium of film, they want a little bit more because they feel like maybe it's unearned. I'm not sure exactly like what the sentiment as a whole is coming from kind of people that felt those things. But yeah, I mean, it's so tough. Cause like you want to really kind of take that in as a filmmaker and be able to kind of like harness that obviously in different ways for your next project, but you want to really, I mean, I think I've always improved in my filmmaking because I really want to hear criticism. Like I want to hear what people thought about the film in terms of not just what they liked, but what they really thought needed work or what they thought what didn't work for them. So like, you know, I've really kind of, cause I'm working on my next project that I hope to shoot next summer, but who knows, you know, like you really kind of want to take that in cause that's hearing stuff like that is only going to improve your script, you know, in your future scripts. So it's kind of like, you know, thinking about, you know, your intent, and then what people got out of, you know, that intent, and then how you can improve in the future.
I wanted to go back to the character Peckerhead himself. I was wondering, 13 minutes is an oddly specific transformation time. Yeah. Why did you pick that?
I mean, I think in the whole origin story or the rules, there was, I would say this is a really nice kind of like callback to the talk about, you know, the script basically being in the first draft what you see. Probably the biggest change from the first draft to the kind of the final was I had a lot more not backstory, but I had a lot more rules to that, not just a transformation, but him being a thing, right? Or whatever you want to call it, a monster, a ghoul, whatever. Is that a lot more rules? And my girlfriend at the time, now wife, who's like, gives me some of the best notes on my work, was just like, you know, there's so much here. There's so many rules and things to consider and things to follow. You need to cut this down. You know, it doesn't hurt to have a little bit of ambiguity here. You know, by having so many rules, by having to remember so many things, it really is slowing down the narrative. It's slowing down the energy. You know, we already had issues in the second act of it kind of slowing down a bit. So she's like, I think you should just really strip it down and give like a few, like, you know, a handful of things that are really easy to follow. And for me, like 13 minutes was just like, that's easier to kind of be able to kind of turn a blind eye, right? Is like, it's just such a short frame of time, gives him enough time to kind of do his business. But in general, I quickly learned that feedback was really kind of well focused and well honed in that, you know, it really helped to kind of keep the movie chugging along. Is that, you know, the diner scene to begin with is the longest scene in the film, and he's giving a little bit of backstory, a little bit of the rules. And then from there, you can kind of just like, it propels you forward into the rest of the film. And before that, there was just so much. There were so many things that I tried to kind of like include in terms of like the elements of that, of his situation and his predicament, that I felt that just by giving kind of like a quick, you know, few things, then the movie could kind of like move forward, and then people wouldn't have to keep like, oh yeah, okay, so he's in this moment, he can be this, in this moment, he's not, you know, just keeping it as easy and as clear cut, because that's just to facilitate the, you know, the narrative or the action.
Okay, so obviously you had much more backstory and origins written down.
Oh, totally. And even, you know, from the first draft to the next, what I did for each character is I wrote up like a 3 to 5 page backstory of like where they've been coming into the first scene of the movie, or their first scene in the movie. So I asked them all not to tell each other, you know, what they know and what they don't know about other characters. Obviously Peckerhead didn't know the three, but like, you know, Max, Mel, and Judy, you know, like I asked them not to share any of what was in that paper. But I think that's something that really helped them to feel kind of fully fleshed out, even on those first few days of shooting. Is, and with Peckerhead specifically, I gave him his backstory of how he came to be, what knowledge he has about that thing beyond what he's told them. And David did kind of bring a little bit of that into his performance and the way in which he kind of reflects on his situation.
And also I felt like I had to bring this up as well, that, you know, obviously as a dedicated metalhead myself, I was obviously massively offended by the metalhead scene. or I was also wondering though, was that scene at all influenced by the infamous short film Heavy Metal Parking Lot?
I absolutely love Heavy Metal Parking Lot. And I believe there's like sequels to it. I have like a kind of a bootleg DVD of the original, the OG Heavy Metal Parking Lot. So yeah, I mean, obviously those are different types of metalheads, but yeah, I mean, I absolutely love Heavy Metal Parking Lot. There's a song by this band Slapstick that was kind of a ska punk band in the 90s called There's a Metalhead in the Parking Lot. And I just remember, I mean, growing up in Jersey in the 80s and the early 90s, I mean, you know, when you'd be, you know, grocery shopping with your parents, you know, on a Friday night or in a Friday evening, and you're coming out, like, the people that were, or, you know, the 7-Eleven or the convenience store, you know, the kids loitering, by and large, at least where I grew up, were metalheads, you know? And I know you were saying it in jest, but I mean, you know, some of my best friends are metalheads. I love, like, all incarnations of the metalhead or the metal genre. But it was both kind of taking, you know, an inspiration from a song title. Certainly, Heavy Metal Parking Lot, I absolutely adore. So kind of just having that be kind of an influence in ways I probably can't understand. But just the influence of being a kid growing up in New Jersey in the 80s and the 90s. You know, just being kind of transfixed by metalheads and these kids loitering and kind of like having this kind of like shit kicking kind of like a, like kind of, you know, like energy to them. I always wanted to kind of have a scene of just kind of like these kids kind of headbanging, you know, in their parents' four-door sedan, you know, coming, driving into the parking lot in a parents' four-door sedan, but just like headbanging in the middle of the night to, you know, like speed metal. And I just tried to weave it into the narrative in some way to kind of really kind of get Mel and Max in kind of Peckerhead's corner. But to answer your question, I am a friend to metalheads, despite how I depict them in the medium of film.
Oh, that's lovely. And yes, I did say it in jest. It was a very fun scene. I was also kind of intrigued by the actual sound of the band, Duh, because like the first gig they play, when they do that gig where the guy pays them like $3 and stuff, you see like a small snippet of their sound. And, you know, it makes them look like they're like a hardcore kind of punk band a la Black Flag or something. And then like the other times you see them perform, they're like a kind of Warped Tour type pop punk band. And I was like, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I've heard that too, because I know like they kind of like people have said, you know, after that first song they kind of have a like a Green Day vibe to them, or like you said, like kind of a Warped Tour pop punk vibe. And that first song, I mean, that first song, the type of thing is I wanted it to be intentional, that this was like a really kind of, because I wanted to show this band that's kind of depicted in this kind of soft cartoony way in the opening, but then like, and they're kind of like just like suffering through this sound check, and they don't have like the confidence, you know, and they seem kind of like out of sorts, you know. And you'd expect that once they start playing that it's going to be really bad. It's going to go really poorly for them. But I really wanted this idea specifically with the Max character of like, once he's once they're playing, there's just kind of like, it's almost like they're harnessing like lightning, right? Like, it's just kind of like this energy is kind of like coming in and kind of like charging them up. And I wanted to kind of show this juxtaposition of how they kind of like encounter that. And to me, like, I mean, some of my favorite punk bands, even though like I love Black Flag, and I love me some Green Day, is, you know, some of my favorite punk bands can kind of like, you know, traffic in like multiple genres of punk, is they can have harder albums or harder songs and then have more melodic punky songs or more melodic kind of like pop punky songs. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that was like totally intentional, but that was definitely like Jeff wrote to what few notes I gave in terms of like, this is what we're looking for in this scene. And then for some of them too, it was like, he had written like a bunch of songs and I'm like, I want to use this song in this moment. So it's like a mix of different things, but yeah, I mean, it is tough to kind of categorize them within the genre of punk, because I think they kind of are trafficking in, and I think that speaks to perhaps a band that is kind of green in that they're kind of like dipping their toe and they're trying to figure out, okay, like what's our voice here? You know, who are we? What type of music are we trying to make here? Are we trying to do like the Muffs? Are we trying to do like Green Day? Are we trying to do like, you know, like you said, Black Flag, or like, you know, more like kind of thrashy punk music? So I think they're kind of like feeling it out themselves.
And I think that's one of the good things about the film as well, is, you know, like lots of times you see a band in a film and they're whatever, but like, you know, they're like decent, they're good.
Yeah, I mean, that just speaks to Jeff, who, I mean, prior to even becoming friends, I was a fan of the bands he was in. He was in this band, The Holy Mess. He was in this band, Scarier Area. Right now he's in a band called 500 Bucks that are like incredible. And Jeff is just like a insanely talented musician, and like a really kind of tuned in, thoughtful, like beautiful person, like one of my best friends, but he's also like one of the best collaborators you could ask for. And I mean, he went above and beyond in terms of like, you know, the writing process. He assembled the, like, Bill Orender, who played drums, he like on the recording, this guy Bill played, and then Augusta Koch, who did Judy's voice. They like, he enlisted them, he like organized the recording, and he's really kind of the foundation of this movie, in addition to like, you know, a handful of other people.
Well, Matthew, I'd love to talk to you more, but I know you have to go, so I'll ask just one more question then. I know that you're currently working on the second part of the Duh trilogy, Larry Goes Demon. How far along are you with that?
Yeah, so I mean, like you said, thank you for the plug. And the Larry Gone Demon is the second installment. I have a Duh trilogy in mind, so it's all happening in the Uncle Peckerhead world. I'm basically, the script is locked, it's ready to go. We have a rough budget. Scheduling is obviously tough in this COVID world in which we now live. But I mean, in reality, like, I'm confident in the script, or as confident as somebody like me would be, cautiously optimistic, I'd say. You know, and I'm ready to kind of like, I'm ready to move on it. I have like, you know, some people in place, like some of my collaborators that I've worked with before that have produced and helped kind of like bring the movies to fruition. So really, I mean, it is trying to figure out how we're going to come up with money. We have some like very minor investment interest, but obviously they want to know like when we plan to shoot, you know, and obviously everything's up in the air. So the hope is, you know, the optimistic, perhaps naive thought is maybe summer 2021. I think it's just kind of like seeing where we are, vaccination wise, where really the country is, you know, after November, and kind of, you know, working from there. But, you know, if I can just do a quick plug, if you go to UnclePeckerhead.com or SubtleTrex.com, you can read more about Larry Gone Demon. You can also read about another project that I have in the works called Bloody Axe Wound, which is both being pitched as a TV series any feature film, whichever one people are willing to bankroll. But also, I just wanted to say, Scott, this was like, I also feel terrible that I have to bow out. But this was like really such a wonderful conversation, as usually, you know, and there's nothing wrong with it, but you know, usually I'm doing kind of 10 minute, just kind of hitting on the major points of where did you come up with the idea and stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that. I love doing those. And I think that gives people kind of a taste of what the movie's all about. But it was really great to be asked, like, I mean this sincerely, like such thoughtful questions. And it's clear, and it means a lot that you watched and thought about the movie. And it was really such a pleasant conversation, at least on my end. So I just wanted to say thank you. And I hope it went well on your end too.
Absolutely, it did. It was a great conversation. And thank you very much for coming on the show, Matthew. And please do not hesitate to come back when Larry Gondemon or the Bloody Axe, you know, comes out.
I'd love to. I'm happy to be a guest at any point. So please don't hesitate to reach out, and I'll definitely bother you once those movies get underway.
That was my guest Matthew there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show, as well as to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest edition of the pod. Remember, if you like what you heard, the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Plus, be sure to join me again in just a few days' time for New Horror Express's Grimfest special. As well as that, tune in next Monday when we will be chatting to another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!